Good morning, Steve Dale on WGN. A controversy in the dog training world, but first...
Get your greasy little face up next to the radio because it's time for America's favorite radio program, Animal Stories. And now here in person is the Animal Stories news team anchorman, your charming and delightful old Uncle Lair, and him in person, little Tommy. Hi, Tommy.
Good morning, Uncle Lair. Good morning. Hi, everybody.
Sound familiar? Well, people tell me I grew up listening to you. Stories from behind the mic, radio royalty. Here he is. Mr. Tommy Edwards. I'd like to say Sir Tommy Edwards or Your Lordship. Because,
oh, no. Yes. Stop.
No,
Steve,
it's true. It's true. Because you know that I grew up listening to you. In fact, I don't know that you'd remember this, but I was an intern 7,800 years ago at that radio station that you worked at. And these features called Animal Stories. And it was maybe the first animal story before it was a regular feature. And I was pulling this yellow paper called the ticker, and I was looking for animal stories because you and Mr. Lujak knew that I liked animals, and I would look for these funny stories, and it was one of the first things I did in radio. So I need to thank you because I don't know that I'd be standing here 22 years at WGN Radio without you. And I know.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm not done, and I know there's more, and I know you're. Your words and you've always been so gracious at events and supporting of colleagues has influenced other people aside from me. I do not stand alone. I do stand on the shoulders of folks that have come before me, and you're one of them. So how did the idea for this book come about? I suppose it's because people tell you all the time, indeed, I grew up listening to you.
Well, that was like one of the last things that came to my mind was the title of the book. Before that, I had just experienced so many crazy things, not only in my career in radio, but just my life in general, that I just started jotting down notes a long, long time ago. It was pretty much after I read a book by one of the guys that was on ABC News, and he wrote a book called Before the Colors Fade, and that term right there has always stuck with me. So I wanted to write down stories before the memory started to fade or the colors started to fade. And as I was going through this, and my wife started reading some of these old stories, and she said, you ought to put this thing in a book. Well, by that time, we started thinking about what are we going to call it, and it just came to me. I thought, all the time I hear people saying, oh, I grew up listening to you, or my dad and my mom said they grew up listening to you, and things like that. So I thought, well, that's kind of a unique title, so that's where we went with it.
Cool. And you probably wanted to sell more books than Super Jock. That's Lou Jack's book.
That's not going to happen.
I don't know. Today there's other ways to sell books, like Amazon, which, by the way, friends, you can get this book on Amazon. So tell me, because I could not do this interview without asking you this question because people would scream and yell at me. What was it like to work with Larry Lujak?
It was really one of the most exciting experiences in my career. I have worked with so many and met so many legendary broadcasters in New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles, but it was Larry Lujak who influenced me most, and we became very, very close friends. And I really got to know him in a very personal way where he felt very comfortable talking to me about all kinds of different things. And so that was really the proof about how close our friendship was.
Well, it was because he wasn't the kind of guy that you'd sit down with instantly upon meeting and he'd say, let's go down and have some beer. That was not him. He was not an open, you know, we would have conversations way back when because he knew of my interest in nature and he was hugely interested in protecting wildlife, the natural world and all of that. And that's how that, at least I was an intern, he'd at least have a conversation with, but, and it wasn't that he was being rude. I think that he was kind of shy, really.
He was. No, you've got a good idea there. I mean, he was to the point where he was uncomfortable in large settings, and when he was behind the microphone in a studio where the only other person in the room was the board op, or what we call the engineer, he could be himself. And he just kind of tuned that engineer out and just talked to the microphone, talked to the people. And that's when he was most comfortable.
And I don't want to, you know, yes, Lujek, and you did work with legends, but you're among those legends, and one of your abilities is to make it seem so easy and seamless. And that's not easy to do in any industry or any craft, and boy, you certainly know your craft. How did Animal Stories first come about?
We, at the 50,000-watt radio station, like WGN, the station WLS was broadcasting early in the morning and could be heard all over the Midwest. So the FCC license at that time required like 1 minute of agricultural news. And Larry would find not only the price of hogs or the price of wheat or something like that, but he would look for interesting barnyard stories, that kind of thing, especially if it had a hint of humor. And then the way he could tell a story, it was very, very funny. And that's really how it all started. Then one day, while I was in the studio, he said, listen, I've got a couple of stories here, and I'm thinking about doing a thing called Uncle Lair's Animal Stories, and I'll introduce myself, and then I'll say, you're little, what are we going to call you, little Tommy? And I went, how about little Snot-Nosed Tommy? He went, yeah, that's it, okay. And that happened just like 30 seconds before we went on the air.
And did you have any idea at some point along, you'll tell me how many years you did this together, at some point in time that, okay, this is going to be, there's going to be a vinyl, at that time, record album. This is going to be remembered all these years later on the radio.
No. We never thought that it was going to last a long time. We just decided to do it that day. And then the next day he said, hey, you want to do it again? I found some more stories. And so we would do it again, and this time it went a little long, and the boss came in and said, why don't you tone it down just a little bit? And then we're thinking, oh, wow, I guess he wants us to make this a daily bit. Okay. And so we did, and we toned it down and said that we had to tone it down, and the switchboard went crazy. People said, what do you mean, tone it down? We want longer. We want more. So that's how it really got to be what it became.
Very cool. And I think sometimes in the industry that we're in, that chemistry, whatever that word means, either happens or it doesn't. Program directors, and I know you were once a program director, so please don't be insulted, sometimes choose that personality and that, and it, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You guys had something together. What was that?
Well, that's what it was. It was chemistry. And like you said, no, I totally agree with you. You can have one person say, okay, you work with this individual, and I hope you have chemistry. Well, that rarely happens, but if you witness it both on the air or off the air, you could witness this in the lounge, in the jock lounge, or just hanging around the radio station, how two people just kind of click and feed on each other's humor. And anyway, that's what happened, because I followed him on the air. I was in the studio for the last half hour of his show, and we'd start talking about some things on the air in commercials and things like that, and start laughing, and people loved it, and the clients loved it.
Now, here's a question that probably with all the interviews you've not been asked, but you guys, as I alluded to, Mr. Lujek indeed, and I do call him Mr. Lujek indeed, was a fan of nature and wildlife, and he knew about it. You, an animal lover as well, did that play into it at all or not really?
We both loved animals. I mean, he really loves animals. He did not have a pet. I think probably the reason for that was because of his crazy hours. A lot of people don't realize he would get to the radio station around 5:30 in the morning, and sometimes not even leave the radio station until 5 or 5:30 p.m. I mean, he'd be there all day. His wife, Jude, travels a lot, so that they really didn't have a family that could have a pet or anything. I had a basset hound named Frankie. And he would always talk to me about Frank. He'd say, that killer basset hound of yours, you know, and all that. And I said, yeah, that's right. He's, you know, actually, Frank was one of the more shy, docile little creatures that we just absolutely loved in our family. Anyway, and so he really did love animals. And he watched nature programming on television whenever he had the chance.
Yeah, and it's, I'm sorry for your loss of your dog. You were the broadcaster for the Chicago Bulls, the live announcer right there. At the stadium, United Center, for, I don't know, you'll tell me how many years. I can't imagine you did not see The Last Dance.
Oh, I did see it, of course, yeah. I started working there when I was back at the Chicago Stadium back in 1976. I did 25 seasons with the Bulls. I missed the championship years because my primary career was radio, and CBS hired me and sent me to Boston for two or three years, made a station number one, then they transferred me out to Los Angeles to do the same thing. So I missed the championship years, but I was there when Michael came on board. I was there when I created the iconic intro of using Cirrus by Alan Parsons Project and the introduction of the players and all that, which is now copied all over. And the first to use things like Rock and Roll Part 2 by Gary Glitter and all the other top 40 pop songs that are in the NBA right now.
Yeah, yeah. And you're part of the reason for that. And things that you hear on the radio that you might take for granted, you'd never know, friends, unless you're in the industry. But this guy, Tommy Edwards, is the reason for that, too. It's a great read. People tell me I grew up listening to you. Stories from behind the mic. Kind of brings you backstage behind the curtain of what it was all about back in the day. And we follow you and your career as well. Tommy Edwards, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Steve. Have a wonderful show.
So cool to talk to Tommy Edwards. Steve Dale back on WGN. Stephen Frost is a dog trainer right here in the Chicago area with a sound beginning. A Karen Pryor certified trainer using positive reinforcement, which is part of the point of this entire interview, Stephen, because here's what I've noted around the country and one of the reasons why we wanted to chat today. So increasingly, and this is a great thing, I cannot stress that enough, I am all for saving all of the dogs we can save. I don't care what the breed is. I don't care what the mix is. It doesn't matter to me. If you can save a dog, I want to save that dog. But there is pressure now among, which is what I want you to talk about, dog trainers to save them in a week. You have a week to rehab this dog who for 6 years has been, quote, an aggressive dog. Or some period of time, because then you have to go on to the next dog. And the way in which this is done under that pressure isn't necessarily positive reinforcement, which we'll talk about more. So have you also, you're in the trenches, I'm really not. Have you noted that what I'm saying is true, that this really is a trend?
So first off, thanks for having me, Steve. I just want to say that, you know, I have noticed that unfortunately there's been a lot of pressure. There's been a lot of pressure from people that are outside of this professional field. And something that I have personally noticed is that, you know, just because we own dogs ourselves or we're passionate about dogs ourselves doesn't necessarily mean we have credentials in the same way that allows us to speak professionally about not only potentially the future of these dogs, but what we can do to work with these animals, much in the very same way that even though I drive a car every day and I make sure to get my oil changed, that does not make me a professional mechanic in any way, shape, or form. So much to that end, and your point, I do feel that there is a great amount of pressure out there to save and work with these dogs at almost any cost. And oftentimes, that not only is compromising a sense of ethics to these animals, but in the very same way, what we're seeing are strategies that are employed that might give the illusion that these animals are effectively fixed or rehabilitated, but it's exactly that. It is an illusion. It's not an emotionally sustainable strategy that truly oftentimes allows these animals to go out and be successful within the community or even within a home or a rescue organization to that end.
So what we saw on television were dogs that were sometimes in desperate straits. The owner said, you have 3 days to do this, to a television dog trainer who called himself the Something Whisperer. And what he taught us, he did teach us something, that you can edit. He taught us that. But aside from that, that he taught us that you can intimidate a dog to do something, but it doesn't mean the dog has really learned. It doesn't mean the dog's brain chemistry has actually changed, which does mean, in my view, and actually demonstrated by science now, that you have a ticking time bomb. Would you agree with that?
So I would agree with that. And I think something that is very important for us to always remember is that it's not just a simple equation that reinforcement increases behavior and punishment decreases behavior. Yes, to a modest degree, that's very true. But there's a lot of variables, both blatant and hidden, and those variables are emotional in nature, and it's emotions that drive behavior. And dogs, much like many creatures, ourselves included, also learn by association. And when we look at simplistic fixes, where we attempt to simply punish and even punish very harshly behavior out of a dog in an attempt to rehabilitate that animal, we're ignoring that emotional component. And what often ends up happening, much as you just mentioned, is that yes, indeed, we do create a ticking time bomb, and it very much so is a emotionally unsustainable strategy.
So what we're really talking about are two different issues, but both related. One is the fact that, have you had your nails manicured recently, Stephen?
Personally, I have not, but many lovely ladies in my life I know certainly have.
Okay, I have not either, ever in my life, but I don't know, maybe I should. The person who does that needs a license. Currently, dog trainers have no national standard or national licensure, so there are people getting into it saying, I can do this, or if they're not actually doing it or trying to, they comment very loudly at times in social media about their quote-unquote expert views, of which they're not really expert on just because they've had a dog in their life for many years. So I think that's one issue that we're talking about. And the other is the pressure to, quote, rehabilitate these dogs. And I would argue, Stephen, it's not a politically correct thing to say, but I'm going to stand here and say it, that some dogs, not most, but some dogs just can't be. And by working over and over with that dog, you're doing something that is potentially dangerous to the community. By allowing that dog, even if you can, for a time, prevent a behavior you don't want to see, aggressive behavior, for a time, you're in the long run doing a disservice to the community and creating a potential danger to the community and ultimately doing a disservice to the dog. So two big issues there for you to comment on.
So I have to agree, and I think you're right in that respect. And I think to one end, you know, again, what we need to understand is that just the science of behavior is quite complex in and of itself. And when we're looking at people advertising themselves effectively as professionals, you know, we need to make sure that that individual that is advertising themselves as a professional, or at a minimum is feeling inclined to speak out quite loudly advocating themselves as a professional, really does have the appropriate credentials to do so. And, you know, certainly something that I would like to see that I've been made aware of that may potentially be in the works is that we do, unfortunately, need regulation in this field to make sure folks that are, you know, accepting people's money and you know, making a variety of different promises with regards to dogs and canine behavior truly have the skill set and appropriate credentials to do so. So that certainly is one issue that I agree with. And then to take that a step further with regards to our second issue, while it really is a unfortunate thing, I certainly have to agree. You know, we have different breeds for different needs. In that respect, dogs are something that humankind has created, has domesticated from wolves, you know, several thousand, tens of thousands of years removed from wolves in that respect. And unfortunately, domestication in of itself, not to get too terribly into it, is something of an ongoing journey as opposed to a destination. And with that, it is quite unfortunate that we will see animals that both through genetic predisposition as well as suffering quite terribly and unfortunately severe trauma, and many times a combination of the two, despite our best efforts for rehabilitation, can otherwise be quite dangerous, not only to the people directly working with them, but potentially unsuspecting members of the community. So I wholeheartedly agree with you in that respect.
Yeah, so we're singing the same song here, and the reason why I'm talking to you about this, I think it's important for the public to know and understand that this is an issue. And I guess one thing I didn't bring up that's also, so there's a third, and that is the methods that are used that can be used successfully to rehabilitate a dog as opposed to methods that are used to give an appearance to rehabilitating a dog.
Indeed. So to speak upon that, keep in mind, you know, with either heavier-handed methods or more what we refer to as traditional punishment based methods, they can suppress behavior very, very quickly. But something to be mindful of is that while with suppression of behavior, dogs do learn by association, and it's often emotional associations, conditioned emotional responses that drive behavior. So if I correct an animal for acting aggressively, and I do so harshly enough, theoretically, I could suppress that quite quickly, and I have seen that done before. However, understand that it was a negative emotional response that was driving that behavior to begin with. So if the correction is contingent upon the behavior, but the behavior itself, the aggression potentially, is contingent upon a trigger or a stimuli, a person or another animal or a certain situation, well, then what ends up happening is that correction becomes very much so contingent upon that stimuli as well, since that's the only time in which you're otherwise offering this behavior. And again, dogs being creatures that learn by association. So while it may give the illusion of seemingly working a miracle and fixing this dog, what inevitably and oftentimes ends up happening is that we see a significant resurgence of that problematic behavior that is now several times worse than the original behavior that we saw. So to that end, even though it may take longer, even though it may take more of an investment in understanding of behavior science and understanding of contemporary methods, a reinforcement-based strategy where we counter-condition a dog by changing around their emotional response, where we teach alternative or incompatible behaviors as coping strategies and truly empower that animal to exhibit that appropriate behavior, while that might take a lot longer and a lot greater investment on our end, it is thoroughly an emotionally sustainable strategy in many situations where punishment simply is not. And I can't stress enough that, you know, for those seemingly miracle fixes, very often it is an illusion. And what's so very important, not only for the public, but especially for many rescues and organizations that are out there, is we need to look at the data. And we need to look at, you know, how do we define success? Does that simply mean that it is just not our problem anymore because the animal was adopted? Or does that mean that we check in 6 months from now, a year from now, 2, 3, 4 years from now, and learn that the animal is either, you know, still doing well or has otherwise, engaged in potentially detrimental behavior that threatens its ability to safely reside within the community?
Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
Talking to Tommy Edwards, how cool is that? And I do really remember, I could picture exactly where the ticker tape, I think that's what we called it, machine was, that big, huge thing. I mean, there were no computers then. This was decades ago. And we had giant yellow rolls of paper that you'd have to change. And my job was to look for animal stories. Wouldn't that figure? And a perfect way to kind of start off the animal career, at least, on the radio. On the radio next week or the week after, I'm not sure, but we will, I am sure, talk with Susan Russell. That name sound familiar? She was the director of animal care and control for the city of Chicago. What's she doing now? Well, among other things, she's written a book about cats, mostly for kids, but she says adults too. So we're going to catch up with Susan. I very much look forward to doing that. See you next week on Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN.